Good. First of all, I need to thank Alan for inviting me to be here. So what I'm going to talk about today, as you see in the title, is to find a way of fine-tuning the inhibitory chondroitin sulfate proteoglycans in promoting regeneration and also plasticity. Before I actually go into my talk, I want to ask you a quick question to help me to prime my talk better. Before you come to this meeting today, how many of you actually know that chondroitin sulfate has different forms? If you do know, raise your hand. And how many of you know that they're actually having different properties on the neurite growth? Only a few hands. So what I want to tell you about is that, as Andreas and also Just has done a very good introduction earlier, so there are different forms of chondroitin sulfate proteoglycans, but most of the people probably know about chondroitin sulfate proteoglycans as a very inhibitory molecules. And the main reason why we are thinking like that is because chondroitin sulfate proteoglycans is highly upregulated in the nervous system after injury, especially in the spinal cord, as you can see in this picture. So what you're seeing here, the blue staining, is the chondroitin sulfate proteoglycans. So this is the lesion in the spinal cord, and after the injury in the spinal cord, you see this upregulation of this particular sugar structure. And so this is just to tell you what I'm going to tell you today. So I will first start my talk in to tell you that most of the people, why we were thinking that in the last 10, 20 years, that chondroitin sulfate proteoglycans, this particular sugar, we all take it as a same entity, same sugar residue, that it is like a candy, like the jelly beans that you see here, there's no difference between them, they all look the same. And then in the last 10 years, we start discovering that actually different chondroitin sulfate glycans are actually having different effects. So for example, the 4-sulfate is more a stronger inhibitor, while as chondroitin 6-sulfate is not as inhibitory as the chondroitin 4-sulfate. And then later on, then I will also show you some of the data that we have obtained in terms of CSE, which you heard earlier in your talk. That these glycans is present and reached in the structure of perineuronal net, and it is involved in regulating plasticity. So what I want to show you here is that different candies are actually having different taste and different properties. And you certainly, if you go into a pot of candies like that, you will pick the one that you like, not the one randomly in the baskets. So the first reason why people are thinking that chondroitin sulfate glycans is actually inhibitory is comes from this paper from Diane Snow very early on in the 1990s. So what you are seeing here in pink is the areas which is quoted with increasing concentration of CSPG, 0.2 milligram per mil, 0.4, and then 1. And when they put the chicken, the algaes, in the presence of this substratum, coated CSPG, what you see is, sorry, I want to show this one, is that in areas with high concentration of CSPGs, you basically don't have any axons going into the area, suggesting that these areas are highly inhibitory. And this is actually a high modification of, it wasn't a video at that time, but this is starting from 0 minutes to 86 minutes of a growth cone coming into the CSPG-enriched areas. And you can see that the CSPGs, the growth cones are not growing into the CSPG-enriched area, but instead just going along it. So one of the main targets or main research aim in our lab is basically to try to remove the CSPG in the glial scar and to help regeneration of neurons across the lesion area. And one of the key tools that we have been using is an enzyme called chondroitinase. And what this enzyme, this bacterial enzyme, is doing is to digest this non-sugar chain into disaccharides. And afterwards, in a lot of different experimental paradigm, that injection with chondroitinase, you will see a better regeneration both in terms of number of fibers passing through the lesion area and also in terms of functional outcome. And as I said, it has been demonstrated in multiple experimental paradigms that it is very effective. So up till here, people are always thinking that different chondroitin sulfates are actually performing equally bad, inhibit the neural regeneration equally bad in the nervous system. So, but then what we find out in the end is that instead of that, they're all like jelly beans. They're actually having different properties. It comes from these few papers that published around 5-10 years ago. So in this paper, in our collaborator Herb Geller has shown that chondroitin 4 sulfate is actually negatively regulating axon guidance. And also very early on in Kasuki Sugihara's work, they also see different patterns of chondroitin sulfates during development. So you are seeing here is in embryo, in the development of the, in the nervous system of the embryos, at different days in the chick embryos, you see that the 6 sulfate is actually present in a very high quantity. It decreases upon the maturation of the nervous system. And then if you look at the ratio of the 6 sulfate against the 4 sulfate, the 6 sulfate is actually decreasing upon maturation of the nervous system, while as 4 sulfates increase. So if all these sulfates are performing equally bad to the nervous system, then why do we have actually different trends of these sulfates during the development? So, and on top of that, in our recent study, we also have shown that actually different types of sulfation change in terms of their percentage during the maturation in the nervous system. This is P0, this is P21, and this is in adults. And you, as you can see, the 4 sulfates has increased from around 60% to about 90%, while as CS6 sulfate has decreased drastically from 18% to around 2.5%. So obviously there are differences between different sulfations in the nervous system. So at the time when we start looking at the role of the different sulfates in the nervous system, James has published this paper that chondroitin 6 sulfate is upregulated in the nervous system. At the time when we started this project, we were thinking that chondroitin 6 sulfate, because it upregulates after injury, and because there's no regeneration after spinal cord injury, we were thinking that 6 sulfate must definitely be a very, very bad guy. And our experiments actually have shown that we were very wrong in these circumstances with this assumption. So what we have done is to make use of an animal which we have knocked out the 6 sulfotransferase in this animal. And so in these knockout mice, what they were having is a very minimal amount of chondroitin 6 sulfate. And then we performed 2 different types of injury. One is a lesion in the nigrostriatal pathway in the CNS, and the second one is cutting the median and ulnar nerve in the peripheral nervous system and see how they actually regenerate after the lesion. So what you saw here is that in a wild type animal and in the knockout animal on the right hand side, WFA staining, which is a lectin labeling the perineuronal net in red, and then TH staining in green. So what you're seeing is that in the wild type animals, you do have a lot more green axons present in the lesion area, which is dotted by this line here. Whereas in the knockout animal, so the number of regenerating neurons is a lot less. So this is the fiber count in these animals. So if the chondroitin 6 sulfate is really that inhibitory, what we are expecting is that when you knock these out, we should have a much better regeneration. But instead, what we are seeing is that these animals are actually having a lot less fiber regenerated in after the lesion. This is a story in the central nervous system, but how about in the peripheral nervous system then? So what you are seeing here is a functional recovery assays of different functions that we are looking at the ability of the animals and using their front paws. So we are testing the number of pellets that they can actually pick with their paws, and also the maximum distance that they can reach with their paws, and also the strength that they are showing. Surprisingly, out of our expectation, that these animals are performing equally well with the wild type animals. So it's certainly gave us a surprise of what we were not expecting. So, and then we went back to look at the enzymes that is responsible for the 6 sulfation. So what you are seeing here is the expression level using PCR to look at the level of expression of the C6ST1, which is the dominating enzyme responsible for producing 6 sulfate, and an isoform of this enzyme called C6ST2, which is responsible normally for 5 to 10% of the production of the 6 sulfate. And in the peripheral nervous system, what you are seeing is that in the knockout animal, you do have a compensatory upregulation of the C6S-T2 after the injury, while as in the central nervous system, you do have these compensatory upregulations. And that's the reason why we were thinking that the quadratin 6 sulfate is responsible for the differences that we saw in the peripheral nervous system and the central nervous system. So is it really that the quadratin 6 sulfate is important in these circumstances in helping the regeneration and also the development of development in the nervous system as well? So what we are doing, we went back to the developmental stage of the nervous system. What we have done is to inject chondroitinase, or chondroitin CSA here is chondroitin 4 sulfate or chondroitin 6 sulfate, into the embryos, and then culture them to 24 to 48 hours. And then afterwards, we look at the commissural neurons of the vestibular nucleus neurons in here in the developing hindbrain to look at what's the effect of removing chondroitin sulfate or in the presence of chondroitin 4 sulfate or chondroitin 6 sulfate during the development and the pathfinding in the embryos. And what we have shown is, what you are seeing here is that in both E11 and a half days with 1 day of culture or 13 days and a half with 1 day of culture, as expected, with the chondroitinase treatment, when you remove chondroitin sulfate in these embryos, 24 hours after the removal, we label the neurons with dye in the rhombomere 4, that is the site of injection. And what you are seeing is the commissural neurons going across, or towards or across the midline as dotted here. And with the removal of chondroitin sulfate, we saw a lot more neurites coming out from the acral nerve innervating into the rhombomere, and also the length of these neurites are a lot longer than the PBS injected control. And how about the chondroitin 6 sulfate injection? That is what we are seeing. So what we are seeing is that chondroitin 6 sulfate injection are giving similarly long neurites as the chondroitinase-treated embryos. And in the later stage, these chondroitin 6 sulfate injected embryos are actually projecting a lot, slightly longer than the chondroitinase-treated embryos. And this is the counting, the measurement of the neurites, of the commissural neurons. So what you're seeing here is the blue line corresponds to the median of the PBS-injected embryos. And the yellow line corresponds to chondroitinase-treated embryos, and the 6 sulfate-injected embryos are indicated by the green line. And as you can see, in the 11 and a half days, the chondroitin 6 sulfate-injected embryos are projecting a lot longer neurites than the chondroitinase-treated embryos. And in the later stage, is similar. So, and then your question probably is then, what about injecting chondroitin 4 sulfate? And the reason why I'm not showing it here is because injection of chondroitin 4 sulfate actually lead to early death in these cultured embryos. So injecting chondroitin 4 sulfate, so more than half of these embryos actually die prematurely before the end of the experiment. And then if you look at the commissural axons in these injected embryos, they're actually having no projections out from the acral nerve. So suggesting that chondroitin 6 sulfate, at least in development in this model, it is beneficial for the extension and the pathfinding, while as chondroitin 4 sulfate is not. So, and then, as what you heard from Joost earlier, so we have also find that there's another sulfate structure called CSE, which is enriched in the perineuronal net. And we have shown that the CSE is important in controlling plasticity by being present in the perineuronal net, controlling what it is binding. So you saw this picture earlier, actually, in Andrea's talk. So this is a early pictures from Golgi looking at the perineuronal net on the surface of neurons. And perineuronal net is composed of CSPG, tenasin R, hyaluronan, and then protein. And with some reasons, these perineuronal nets, these matrix molecules in the central nervous system start aggregating on top of the neuronal surface, forming this very tight pericellular structure. In the spinal cord and both in the spinal cord and in the cortex, they are present mainly in as an aggregated matrix on top of the cell surface. In the spinal cord, we have counted the different types of neurons, the proportions of neurons that is present that are bearing perineuronal net. So 30% of the neurons having nets are motor neurons, 50% are the large interneurons, and 20% of them are neurons mainly in the dorsal horn. So they are certainly not wrapping up every single neuron in the nervous system. They are only present in certain types of neurons. As I think one of the questions that was asked by the lady earlier, that how does the perineuronal net actually present only on the PV neurons? I will tell you the reason later. So this is a picture that we have injected chondroitinase into the brain. The area which is marked with the asterisk are the area which is digested with chondroitinase. And as you can see that with chondroitinase treatment, you can remove not just the loose paracellular matrix, staining of chondroitin sulfate in the brain, but also the perineuronal net staining in the brain as well. So Joost has talked about these experiments in the visual cortex by Tommaso earlier. So in the visual cortex, the reason why people are thinking that perineuronal nets are involved in controlling visual cortex plasticity is because perineuronal nets start wrapping up neurons in the developing visual system, as you can see here from P22 to P100. You see increasing number of cells and also increasing thickness of cells of the perineuronal nets on the cell surface. And in this animal, if you do a monocular deprivation experiment, when you just close one eye of the animals, in adults' nervous system, so what you will see is normally you will have in the binocular region in your brain, in the visual cortex, you will have innervation actually crossing to the contralateral side of the brain. So if I just close one eye, ask you to close one eye for 7 days, when you just shine the light on the eyes that is on that wasn't covered in the last 7 days, what you will see is you will, in the binocular region, you will only see the innervation and the stimulation on the contralateral side of your brain. However, what Tommaso has shown is that if you inject chondroitinase, after 7 days or 15 days of monocular deprivation, what he saw is that by removing the chondroitin sulfate in the visual cortex, probably the perineuronal nets in the visual cortex, what he saw is that you don't have this bias of only activating your contralateral side, but you do have increased activation or stimulation in the ipsilateral side as well. And that is the reason why people start thinking that perineuronal net is involved in controlling visual cortex plasticity. And then because of what we understand about the perineuronal net, and we also have this animal called link protein, cartilage link protein 1 knockout mice. So this is a link protein very important in aggregating the structure of perineuronal net on the cell surface. And in this animal, what you're seeing is a wild type here with staining with WFA and aggrecan. And this is knockout animal. So even though you can still see the remnants of the perineuronal net in these animals, but they are certainly drastically reduced on the cell surface, and they're not in the presence in the early dendrite animals anymore. So in these animals, with reduced perineuronal nets without any chondroitinase treatment, but just knocking out one protein, which is responsible for aggregating this matrix, what you see is in an adult nervous system, in the knockout animal with monocular deprivation, the ratio between activation on the contralateral side against the ipsilateral side is around 1, suggesting that by just knocking out the perineuronal nets, you can actually have a similar stimulation on both sides of your brain in an adult nervous system, suggesting that your nervous system, at least in the visual cortex, is very plastic with a reduction in the perineuronal net. So we have also tested other plasticity system. What you're seeing here is a Cuneate nucleus plasticity in the link protein 1 knockout mice. What we have done here is to denervate 2 digits in your, in the animal's front paw. After denervation, so what we have done is to inject a retrograde tracer in the intact digits, and then look at the innervation in the cuneate nucleus, which is responsible for this for the function of your digits. So what you are seeing here is that the knockout mice with deletion are having more innovation in other areas than the wild type animals with lesion. So what this suggests is that your intact digits is trying to compensate and take over some of the function in these animal, in the denervated digits. So suggesting that they are also more plastic in this area. And in recent experiments, we have also tested the memory of this animal, because if parineuronal net is involved in controlling what synapses or how synapses can be formed, so it is also likely that it is also controlling what you can do with your memory. So as you can see earlier in the talk of Andreas, so actually the quadrating sulfate proteoglycans and also parineuronal that is also present in very strongly in the hippocampus as well. So what we have done here is to put the animals in a Y maze. So you put two objects into the two arms of the Y maze, and then let them habituate with these two objects for 5 minutes. So animal, and then afterwards, with different delay of different times of delays, 1 minute to 48 hours, without seeing anything, then you put this animal back to this Y maze, but instead of having the same two objects, you change one object to a new object. So because the animals, the mouse and rodents, in general, they are very curious animals. So instead of going back to the old objects, what they would do is to go and sniff the new objects. So we measure the time that they are spending on the new object against the old objects and see how good they can actually remember something was old and something was new. So what we have shown here is that in these gray dots here are the animals with the link protein 1 knockout mice. So you can see that the animals with the link protein 1 knockout mice, in the link protein knockout mice, are having are better in discriminating the old object from the new object, while as the wild type animals are not. And then in order to confirm that this is really due to the parineuronal net, but not due to quadrating sulfate, but not due to the link protein 1 itself, what we have done is to inject quadratinase in this animal. And then you can see that we cannot further boost this discrimination of the knockout animal, but we can boost the discrimination of the wild type animals similar to the link protein 1 knockout animal, suggesting that what we are seeing here is due to the reduction of the parineuronal nets in the link protein 1 knockout animals, but not due to the link protein. It's due to the reduction of the parineuronal nets due of the chondroitin sulfates, but not due to the formation of the parineuronal nets. So as I said earlier, so the key things that I want to demonstrate today is that different quadrating sulfates are actually having different effects. Then we were actually also looking at the different disaccharized components in the parineuronal nets. So we have devised a method looking at extracting proteoglycans actually using different buffers. So what you will see here is the disaccharide analysis after extracting it using a normal saline, which is corresponding to soluble proteoglycan or soluble sugar. And then these two fractions you're seeing here is the sugars that is present on the cell membrane. And with the buffer 4, that is 6 molar urea isolation, this is the fractions of the sugars that is present in a highly aggregated complex, including those in the parineuronal nets. So the result is concluded in these two pie charts here on the right. So with the buffer 1 isolation, you can see that in adult brain, the majority of the glycans is actually quadratin 4 sulfate, with a small proportion of non-sulfated CS, and then you have this 1% of CSE. I would like to draw this attention to this 1% CSE present in the parineuronal nets, because in here, as you compare with the buffer 1, this is the loose extracellular matrix compared with the highly aggregated glycans that we isolated with 6 molar urea. What you are seeing here is we increase the proportion of these CSE from 1% to 2%. Yes, the percentage is still rather low. It's only 1 to 2. But if you look at the percentage increase between them, it is almost like double the percentage. And so when we were looking at this data, we didn't think this the involvement of CSC is as important as we would expect. But as you heard from Joost earlier, that semaphorin 3A is binding to the parent neuronal nets very specifically, as you can see here. And actually, in collaboration with Uyck in Grenoble, we have also determined the semaphorin 3A in binding to CSE. So what you are seeing here is a surface plasma resonance experiments looking at the interactions of semaphorin 3A against different lengths of CSE, as you see here. So this is 4 disaccharide against 6 disaccharide. In the 4 disaccharides as a scenario, we don't have much semaphorin 3A binding to the 4 disaccharide CSE, while as the binding to the 6 disaccharide CSE is concentration dependent, and we have also calculated the KD of the binding of the CSE semaphorin 3A against the CSE, and it is actually a very strong interaction between them. So you also heard from Joost earlier, so actually Alan has also done the study looking at the OTX2 binding to perineuronal nets, and they also have suggested that the OTX2 is binding very specifically to CSE. So this is just an experiment, so the biochemical assay looking at what's the function of the semaphorin 3A binding to the perineuronal nets so specifically through the CSE. So what you're seeing here is an ELISA assay looking at different chondroitin sulfates, looking at how semaphorin binds to different sulfates, and you can see here that semaphorin 3A is binding specifically to the CSE unit. With the use of an antibody which is blocking specifically to the CSE, we can reverse this, we can inhibit the binding of the semaphorin 3A from this level to around this level. So suggesting that So the binding of semaphorin 3A is mainly due to the presence of CSE in the glycans. And using our extraction method, looking at the glycans in the soluble fractions against the perineuronal net fractions, doing exactly the same ELISA, what we have shown is that semaphorin 3A is binding very specifically again to the glycans that we isolated from the perineuronal net, but not as strong to the detergent glycans. And again, this binding can be inhibited using this anti-CSE antibody. And the most important experiment here is we have cultured the DLG neurons, adult DLG neurons, in the presence of the semaphorin 3A, perineuronal GAGs, and also this antibody. With the presence of the semaphorin 3A or perineuronal nets, you can see the length of the neurites growing out from the neurons has drastically decreased. And in the presence of both, it further drops down to another like 10-20%. And these effects can be reversed by the presence of, by the addition of the anti-CSE antibody. So it seems that by blocking the CSE using antibody is a tool that we might be able to modulate the semaphorin 3A binding from the perineuronal nets. And recently, we were also looking at the different sulfates that is changing in the perineuronal net in the aged brain, and similar as what we showed earlier, that in the aging brain, there's also a reverse trend of 4 sulfates against 6 sulfates during the aging process. And this particular trend is actually particularly prominent in the glycans that we isolate from the perineuronal nets using buffer4. So this is 4 sulfates, it keeps increasing during the aging process, while as chondroitin 6 sulfates, which is the green line here, is decreasing. So that might be one of the reasons why during aging we are less able to remember things than when we are younger. So this is just a schematic diagram of what perineuronal nets is doing. So you have, so answering that lady's questions earlier of why some of the why perineuronal nets is present on certain populations of neurons is because there's a transmembrane enzyme called hyaluronan synthase is present in the neurons, on the surface of neurons. If you don't have this transmembrane enzyme, you will not have the formation of the perineuronal nets. It acts as an anchor on the surface of neurons to anchor all these extracellular matrix on the surface of neurons. And then OTX2 and also semaphorin 3A is binding very specifically to the glycan chains in these structures. And in order to modulate and manipulate, finding a way to manipulate the plasticity, so one of the ways is to remove the CSPG like using chondroitinase, and the other way of doing that is specifically block some of the sulfation as the evidence that I showed earlier, different sulfation may have different role. If we can find a way in blocking specific sulfation, that may be another way of modulating plasticity. So what I'm going to tell you now is the tools that we have developed in modifying different sulfation. So one of the problems of studying perineuronal nets is that perineuronal nets normally only form during late developmental period upon maturation. Andreas has shown some of the figures that you can do a long-term culture of a hippocampal neurons. Up to 21 days, you start having perineuronal nets form on the net perineuronal nets form on the surface of the neurons. But the problem of that, as you mentioned earlier, is that you only have like 10 to 20% of neurons that might have perineuronal nets. And plus the fact that upon such a long-term culture, it is very difficult to actually manipulate any molecules in the neurons because the neurons are quite fragile. So in order to develop a tool that we can study perineuronal nets and the related molecules, we have tried to create a model of perineuronal nets, which we can actually use for quick screening of different molecules and different substances in controlling perineuronal net formation. So we have developed a model in the HEC cells, which is very robust model, easy to culture. And so we first transfect these cells with the anchor of the perineuronal net, as I told you earlier, it's hyaluronan synthase, which is a transmembrane enzyme to anchor the long chains of hyaluronan on the cell surface. And the second is the link protein, cartilage link proteins, which actually binds the end terminal of the chondroitin sulfate proteoglycans to the hyaluronan. By stably expressing these two proteins in the cells, we were able to create perineuronal nets on the cell surface. This is WFA. These are all live staining of WFA aggrecan, hyaluronan synthase, and link protein. And what you are seeing here is that by stably transfecting these two molecules, we were able to create perineuronal nets on the cell surface in a very robust cell types, the human embryonic kidney cells. And these cells are also behaving very much like perineuronal nets. So what we are doing here is to wash these cells with different buffers. This is TBS, this is 1 molar sodium chloride, this is 2 molar urea with increasing concentration of urea here. So it is only in these cells that we have double transfection of hyaluronan synthase 3 and link protein. Then up to 6 molar urea, you can still see WFA staining on the cell surface of this neuron. It's not as nice as or intact as the 2 molar urea washes, but you can see that these cells with double expression of these two molecules, we can at least have the perineuronal nets after 2 molar urea washes. So we are quite confident that these cells are behaving very much like perineuronal nets. And with the use of these cells, we were able to, so this is just a picture of showing WFA as a marker of perineuronal nets in the PNN HEC cells. As you can see, they're basically wrapping up the surface of the cells. As you can see here, this is a high magnification. The green is the WFA. And the cells are also expressing link protein. And using semaphorin as a way of looking at whether these cells are actually behaving like a perineuronal net. So what you're seeing here in green is semaphorin 3A, in red is WFA. So in the PNN HEC cells, they do form perineuronal net or WFA-bound matrix on the cell surface. And with the addition of semaphorin 3A, you can see that these cells are actually binding very strongly on, semaphorin 3A is binding very strongly on the cell surface. So this is a good model for a quick screening of perineuronal net-related molecules. And what we have done then is, can we actually modulate the sulfates in these cells in order to see whether we can modulate what is going to bind to the perineuronal nets? So making use of these cells, we were in knocking down one sulfotransferase, it's called chondroitin-4 sulfotransferase here. The CSE unit needs to have 4 sulfation first and then has a 6 sulfation afterwards. So by blocking chondroitin-4 sulfate, you can actually block the formation of 4 sulfates, that is CSE, and CSA, and also you can block the formation of CSE as well. With the use of these cells, so CHSD3 here is the there are different forms of knockdown that I'm doing. So this CHSD11 corresponds to these four sulfates. So knocking down four sulfates, we were able to, sorry, I just cut the long story short. Knocking down the four sulfates, you reduce the semaphorin 3A binding to the cell surface. And at the same time, in the present, when we are doing the experiments with the neurite length outgrowth in the DLG neurons, these glycans are no longer inhibiting the outgrowth of the neurites in the presence of the semaphorin 3A. So that is one of the experiments that prove that by modulating sulfation, you might be able to modulate what is going to bind to a perineuronal net. So what tools can we use? I mean, if we really want to do experiments modulating perineuronal nets and plasticity in animals, can we actually do it? That is what we are doing. We are trying to do in the last year and trying to find strategies actually to modulate the sulfation and the plasticity by modulating perineuronal nets. So one of the tools that we have is is an antibody called CAT316. It used to be known as an anti-aggrecan antibody, but in the presence of CAT316, together with semaphorin 3A, you can see the reduction of semaphorin 3A binding to these HAC cells, while as in the presence of semaphorin 3A, it also binds the antibody from binding to the cell surface. So what you are seeing here is the addition of semaphorin 3A only on the cell, on the PNN HAC cells, addition of CAT316 only in the PNN HAC cells, and both of them bind to the cell surface, and in the presence of both, they are both reduced, suggesting that they are competing for the same unit on the perineuronal net, and probably is the CSE that we are talking about. So for that antibody, we are going to move into in vivo experiments just to see whether we can block the semaphorin 3A in the in vivo system. And the second thing that we are developing right now is to develop inhibitors against the four cell full transferase. In collaboration with a chemistry department in Cambridge, we have devised some different types of inhibitors blocking the activity of the four cell full transferase. And in the meantime, we have two candidates which are showing very strong inhibition. And we are further developing these compounds in the meantime. And the third strategy that we have been have been developing is using a inhibitors, which is against the production of hyaluronan. So hyaluronan is important for the formation of the perineuronal net. And by culturing, by the addition of this compound in the PNN HAC cells without treatment, and 1-3 days after the treatment, a single treatment in the presence of this compound, we can reduce the formation of the perineuronal net in the PNN HAC cells. As demonstrated by the WFA, 3 days after treatment, you don't see the green staining anymore, suggesting that WFA or perineuronal net is not forming on these cells, and the same as the link protein as well. We have also injected this compound in the animals intraperitoneally or feeding them orally. What I want to show is basically this picture here. So in the oral administered animals or the IP injected animals, after treatment, this animal has drastically reduced the perineuronal net in the central nervous system. What you're seeing here is in the cortex. So these are the three tools that we are available, we are having in hand right now, and we are going to test whether they are effective in modulating perineuronal net in the central nervous system. So this is just a schematic diagram concluding what I'm telling you today. So what we first started is we know that in the central nervous system, CSPG is upregulated after lesion in the spinal cord. So what we have been trying to do is to use chondroitinase to remove the CSPG in the glial scar. But indeed, CSPG is actually present in different isoforms, and it is also present in the aggregated structure called perineuronal nets. When we started the experiments, we thought they're all bad. Basically, different forms are all showing very inhibitory results. But then what we know now is that actually one of the forms, the chondroitin 4 sulfate, is a bad guy. So even though it is a sweet, but sometimes sweets can also be quite disgusting. You just don't want to touch it. And some of the sweets are actually a good guy. You want to pick it up from the basket. And then some of them are actually neutral, depends on what they are binding to at the end. So by knowing all these results, we are hoping that by the end we can actually fine-tune what sulfation we should be keeping and what sulfation we should be removing in order to increase plasticity in the central nervous system. So what I've been showing today is a collaboration with different people in Europe and also in Asia. So the sugar analysis experiments is mainly done in Professor Sugihara's lab in Japan. And Gunnar and Joost, we have been having a long-term collaboration in the interaction with semaphorin 3A in relation to perineuronal nets. Alan and Uke, we were starting looking at the OTX2 binding in the CSE, and Uke is the one looking at the plasma resonance experiments in relation to the semaphorin 3A. That's it for today. Thank you.